Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief.
Hi there.
On today's podcast, if you believe polls, the presidential race is tighter here in North Carolina than it is anywhere in the country. And if you believe TV ad money, the race for governor is the most expensive. But if your interest in politics and campaigning in North Carolina ended there, you'd be ignoring the many fascinating aspects of the race for U.S. Senate between incumbent Republican Richard Burr and Democrat Deborah Ross. So for the next 20 minutes or so, let's focus on Burr versus Ross. Real Clear Politics, the polling aggregator, has Burr ahead by 2.6 points. So, Jeff, let's start with the incumbent and leader by a slim margin. Who is Richard Burr?
Richard Burr is a two-term member of Congress, had five terms in the U.S. House, was succeeded by Virginia Fox, the fifth congressional district out of North Carolina, which stretches from Winston-Salem up toward Boone and Watauga County. Burr is a Wake Forest graduate. He might have played football there. Don't hold me to that one. And ran for election to the U.S. Senate in 2004, easily won re-election over Secretary of State Elaine Marshall in 2010. We're talking about a 22-year member of Congress. This is somebody who, in previous life, he was a businessman. He sold lawn equipment, lawnmowers, for, I think, 15, 20 years, somewhere in there. Pretty affable guy. A handsome guy, if those folks have never seen Richard Burr before. And Richard Burr is a party liner. He is somebody who has been a good Republican for his time in Congress. He has ascended to the Senate Intelligence Committee chair position, which is a fairly powerful position, and was somebody that, according to the experts and the strategists and the people who know way more about this stuff than I do, expected to coast to victory in 2016. He was a guy who was going to get a third term, and as we have found out, he's not going to run again. This will be his either these are his final months in the U.S. Senate, or this will be his final re-election campaign if he wins. He's not going to run again in 2022. But Senator Burr is in this tight race with Deborah Ross. I mean, you mentioned 2.5 points or so. That falls within just about every margin of error that I'm aware of in these polls in this election season. And it has gotten close. I mean, I think some of this is the year of the outsider. It is Trump. It is the fundraising that Ross did, strong fundraising early on. And she spent a lot of that money. She has elevated her name recognition in recent months. You know, I'm not a betting person. If I were, I think I would still lean slightly toward Burr defending his seat. But this is a race. This is not a race people, you know, anticipated being tight down right. The stretch.
And it's really more this race. I mean, Deborah Ross is pretty unknown. We'll talk about her more in a little bit. But Richard Burr is interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One, as you said, 22 years in Congress, and two terms, full terms, in the U.S. Senate.
Right.
Think about someone like Ted Cruz, who comes in one term in the U.S. Senate, makes headlines, alienates everybody on both sides of the aisle. Richard Burr hasn't alienated anybody, certainly on his side of the aisle, isn't one of those guys who gets out in front of a lot of news stories. He doesn't jump on social issues all that much. What has he accomplished in 22 years in Congress? What is he known for?
That's a good question. He's known for being an enemy of the privacy folks, right? Of the ACLU. I mean, he wants to share information. I mean, this I think has to do more with this committee appointment or this committee role than others. But he wants the government to have surveillance and good surveillance and widespread opportunities to monitor what is going on. I mean, he has butted heads with libertarians and groups like the ACLU over things like that. But in terms of memorable pieces of legislation, and admittedly, I haven't covered politics for 22 years, there's not like a Frank Dodd. I mean, that's a major piece of legislation, but there's not a major piece of legislation that I'm aware of that has Burr's name on it. I mean, being here, he's a champion of the troops. He's a champion of military involvement and, you know, increasing military spending and, I mean, doing what he can for the armed services.
Right.
But I'd flip that to you. I mean, what is it,
what's
his staple?
By any definition, he's a conservative. What right. I think is interesting to me is, you know, he is a North Carolina conservative. He right. ran in that, you mentioned the district that now Virginia Fox represents. Yeah. That's a conservative, no matter how you slice it. That right. is a conservative part of this state. He is, but he's not one of these contentious conservatives. He doesn't get out in front of social issues all that much, which I find interesting. And he is affable and available. I remember right. talking to him on the tarmac of Raleigh-Durham Airport when mm-hmm. Sarah Palin was landing for a campaign event.
Right.
He's more than happy to chat,
right.
talk to you about anything. He's you can't come away from talking to him and not thinking, okay, he's a fairly nice guy. He's not anybody right. who is difficult to be around.
No, but he's not vitriolic. He's not Ted Cruz. He's not Mitch McConnell. He's not...
Right, but conservative to the core.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting about it is he hasn't changed. He's a pretty steady guy. The state is changing a little bit around him,
yes.
you know?
The atmosphere.
This is a guy who would have, I think, won by 10 or 12 points and has, mm-hmm. but 20 years ago, he coasts to re-election.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the demographics have changed
right.
here in the state. And this election is really about those things, demographics and Richard Burr, because as he said, we don't know much about Deborah Ross, but let's talk about Deborah Ross. What do we know about
right.
her?
Right. One quick postscript on just the Burr bio that I think is interesting. I read this within the last couple of days. In terms of social issues, he voted for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is a social issue that he did step into.
Hmm.
And I think some of that had to do with, you know, his role as a North Carolina, a U.S. senator from North Carolina and the military's impact. I mean, presumably he heard from people in the military who were
right.
in support of that, and that's why he went ahead and did that. As for Deborah Ross, she is a former state legislator. She is the former state head of the ACLU. And she is somebody whose policies are pretty left. I mean, you talk about Richard Burr being staunchly conservative and in line with North Carolina voters. One of the concerns with Deborah Ross is, will she be too liberal? Does she lean too far to the left? Are there pieces on her resume, on her track record, that are going to hurt her in a statewide election in North Carolina? That, of course, remains to be seen. She has made up a lot of ground. It's still September 1st as we tape this, so it's early, right?
Right.
I mean, there are a whole bunch of factors that are going to play out. One is money, and
right.
we've seen today on Thursday that the pot of money that the U.S. Senate Republicans have, the majority, they are allocating $8 million of it for Richard Burr for TV ads over the next 8-10 weeks or so. This, to me, is significant because it signifies he needs that. I mean, they're acknowledging that he is facing a real legitimate threat. I mean, in case people were still doubting that, I mean, the polls show this being pretty close, but the U.S. Senate, the piggy bank, I'm forgetting the official name of it, they are allocating this huge allotment of money for Burr to run TV ads.
Right. And it'll be interesting, though, because people who pay attention, voters, they know who Richard Burr is.
Right.
Deborah Ross has the benefit of money, and from what I hear, she's a tireless campaigner. She's running
a lot of energy,
and a very strong, just a campaigner. She's been pretty tireless, and she's been out there. But it's interesting. Not if you look at all the polls, they have high name recognition for Burr, very little for right. Deborah Ross. So, if Burr is only up 2.6, it's much more of a decision that voters are making about him. They want him or they don't want him. As Deborah Ross emerges through debates, through these TV ads, we're going to see not only Burr trying to—it's a race to define Deborah Ross
right.
for most voters. Burr's going to try to define her with television ads. She's going to try to define herself also mostly through television ads. Whoever wins that battle is going to win this race, right? How they define Deborah Ross. Do you think that's true?
I'll go ahead and disagree a little bit because I don't know if it's that linear. I think the Trump factor, the Trump variable is huge here.
Right.
In that Burr's got to figure out this line, and it's not a balance beam or towing a line in the sand. I mean, I think this is a maze through a marsh with crocodiles. Like, how do you get from A to B dealing with the Trump ridiculousness, dealing with the Trump points that do well with Republicans? I mean, I think that's the big X factor for Burr is how do you align yourself with Trump, but also— Burr's not as important as Trump. Burr's not. I mean, what is the effect that Donald Trump's position on this ballot what will it have on Richard Burr?
Right. Burr's got to hope that people don't vote straight ticket anti-Trump, right?
Right.
Because people,
or that people stay home.
Because if you look, Clinton's, you know, ahead of Trump by a point or two in the state, right, closest of anywhere in the country. And Cooper's ahead of McCrory by a little more than that. And only Burr is sort of swimming against that stream by being up as a Republican,
right,
against a Democrat. So he needs people to go in and see a reason to vote for him, right, and not to just go Democrat, Democrat, Democrat down the road.
Right. I don't think it's as simple as Burr could win or lose this race. I think Burr could lose. I mean, or Ross could win or lose his, mm-hmm, take the race. But I think Burr could lose, and it might have something to do with his policies and his campaign and how he did or didn't attack her or debate her, Ross, and also what happened with Trump.
Right.
Whether or not voter turnout was down 6, 7, 8 points from 4 years ago. Whether or not, you know, the voting law being overthrown by the Fourth Circuit and then being upheld by that overturning being upheld by the Supreme Court ostensibly this week, if that has an effect in terms of voter turnout and, you know, brings more people out to the polls who will vote against Richard Burr. I don't know. But to me, the year of the outsider is at the heart of this.
Yeah, it might be. But I feel like still, you know, if you're Richard Burr and you're saying, okay, I've got a pot of money now to make these TV ads.
Right.
Most of those are probably going to be attack ads. They are going to be, because it's close enough now that I need to define my opponent. But you've got to be careful, because in this vitriolic atmosphere we're living in now,
right,
with Trump and all that he brings to the campaigns, if you attack a female candidate in the wrong way, you're going to turn off a lot of voters who don't even know who that female candidate might,
sure,
be. So you were sort of describing the maze he's,
right,
going through. His campaign will have to figure out a way to define her, maybe negatively, pin off some of those liberal ACLU aspects,
sure,
that they think will turn some voters off, and do that in a way that's not going to turn those same voters off toward him,
right,
for being a mini Trump in a way, for being too negative, too whatever. It's,
right,
a really fascinating, I think.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm pretty interested by this race. I think you've got, certainly the governor's race is fascinating for all kinds of reasons. The presidential race is interesting in this state for all kinds of reasons. But this one is, I think, in a lot of ways, unique.
And maybe to extend your point a step further, you talk about alienating voters, keeping in mind that opposite Trump is a female,
right,
for the first time,
right,
is a woman, is, mm-hmm, Hillary Clinton. So how do you navigate this in terms of painting the negative brushstroke on Deborah Ross, saying she's not experienced or saying she's too liberal or saying she doesn't know what she's getting into? Or you can, I mean, maybe more specific to the TPP, mm-hmm, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal was one thing that they are both opposed to, but Burr has criticized her, Ross, for not being in the correct opposition to it or whatever. How do you paint that picture of her without,
right,
alienating,
right,
maybe some Republican women who,
that's,
are going,
right,
to be voting for Hillary,
right,
or independent?
This is a state,
you know,
that has elected a senator, a female senator who's both a Republican, Elizabeth Dole, and a Democrat, Kay Hagan. So this is a state that has no problem electing female, right, senators. And if you begin to attack in a way that can be perceived,
right,
as somewhat sexist, then that's going to probably,
yeah,
go negatively. Now, we have no reason to believe he's going to do that.
No.
And we don't, we're sort of speculating a little bit on how these TV ads might play. But voters know who Richard Burr is. He's a pretty confident campaigner,
right,
very effective, not only on his own campaigns, but campaigns for others.
Right.
So it'll be really interesting to see how this does play out in the campaigns and on the TV airwaves.
Right. And I think we're going to see more from her, Ross, on you know, the economy, and from her standpoint.
Right, I was going to ask, what are the issues that people care about in this race?
I think the middle class, what has happened, you know, I mean, how much of this can you really peg on a U.S. senator? I think we're going to have some more specific attacks about what Burr has voted for, which budgets and which, you know, pieces of legislation he has sent forth, because Ross's stance is that Burr has not done enough for middle class families, for education. And, you know, I think the other piece of this that has emerged in other U.S. Senate races, where incumbents, primarily first term incumbents, Wisconsin, Ohio, New Hampshire, first term Republican incumbents have been targeted by the Democrats. One of the talking points here are judicial vacancies,
mm-hmm,
and
right,
the fact that the Senate hasn't turned in The Senate, you know, is not going to have any hearing for Merrick Garland.
Right.
And, you know, Merrick Garland is, by most accounts, a centrist judge. He's the head of the Washington, D.C. appellate court. And, you know, we have an eight-justice court right now. Furthermore, yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit more nuanced. I don't know if it will really rise to a super important issue in this race, but North Carolina has the longest judicial vacancy in the country. In the Eastern District of North Carolina, there should be four federal judges. They've been operating with three for 10 and a half years. Part of the reason is because Senator Burr has not turned in his blue slip, which is this parliamentary measure which would allow for hearings to take place for a nominee for the Eastern District. By the way, President Obama has nominated two people for that vacancy. Now, Burr's stance is that this is, you know, President Obama has not honored a deal that he and Senator Hagan had with Obama going back some years. Anyway, you can tell that this is a story that I've done previously.
Yes.
But I think that is something that could emerge here.
The Supreme Court will be an issue, right?
Because
if you're going to run on something, whether you're Deborah Ross, whether you're Richard Burr, the future of the Supreme Court really. Because you know, in the governor's race, you can have HB2. Whatever side of these issues you fall on, they can be either trumpeted by your incumbent governor candidate, or they can be hung around his neck in a way. As for Senate, it's much harder because, you know, approval ratings for Congress and Senate in general are at historic lows.
They're in the toilet. Yeah.
That doesn't help necessarily an incumbent. You hinted at this sort of outsider thing gaining some steam. That's not going to help an incumbent. But if you can say to your constituents, or you can say to your voters, the future of the Supreme Court rests possibly on this race, then that's going to be an issue that somebody go, okay, that might make me vote differently than I may just straight ticket it down the line here.
All right. So what do you think of that? I mean, do you think that really matters with it? I'm trying to phrase this question. It obviously matters. But do you think that's going to be an important factor in this thing? Like, yes, U.S. Senate races are incredibly important to the future of the judicial sway in this country. But do you think that is going to influence? You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
I think
here.
It will play for voters. It will
a give, lot of
it,
them.
It will
like,
give
do you think that
voters
really matters?
A reason to care about this race and a reason to possibly make a decision. You remember, we're talking about, and I'm holding my finger and forefinger, my thumb very close together here. We're talking about a very slim. You know, sort of percentage of the electorate.
Who are going to swing this thing?
Who are going to swing it, right?
Yeah.
One way or the other. You talk about 3-4% right in the middle who just need a reason to fill in that bubble.
A couple hundred thousand people.
Yeah. And undoubtedly the same exact people who are going to decide who wins for president in North Carolina and the governor, they are the suburban voters of Wake and Mecklenburg County for the most part. Those folks need a reason. Now, do they care about the Supreme Court every day? No. But if HB2 is decided by, you know, a 4-4, it doesn't, you know, it's they're going to look at it and go, okay, I feel a little bit this way or a little bit that way.
Right.
That's going to make a huge difference. I think Supreme Court, with as much gets hung on them for whether reason, you know, they make very important decisions, obviously, I think that could be a deciding factor. Otherwise, I'm not sure why, because there aren't issues that you can attach to Richard Burr,
right?
You can't say he's done this or he's done that poorly.
Right. Which I think
for the most part, obviously, if you're really
in the weeds,
you can. But
I think that's what turns it into more of a character race.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it all, like hearing you say that in my head, it's like, well, God, there's a disconnect here. Like, if these are the folks that are going to be deciding it, and it's about the Supreme Court, or it's about, you know, how we as a nation are funding our military or education, or how, you know, we're going to deal with Social Security or Medicare, like these are some interesting conversations. There's some layered debates. Like, you know, if that really matters to those people, why aren't we talking about it? We're just going to attack ads, and the character and the portrayal of these two is what's going to decide this, not how they would vote for judgeships or, you know, caring for the elderly in this country.
The other thing that's interesting to me about this race is I think it says a lot about, and you could say this about council of state races too. Any race that is sort of statewide that are not for governor or for, obviously president's not statewide, it's nationwide, but
you're talking about like lieutenant governor.
Yeah, what you've got is sort of this new crop of Democrat candidates, because there have been a dearth the last couple of elections. Whether you're talking about, and I don't want to pick on anybody, but Elaine Marshall wasn't a terribly strong candidate for the Democratic race.
No.
You talk about different
Walter Dalton was a lousy candidate for governor.
That's
not
right.
To pick
he had
on
jump
him,
into it late.
He and came
he
had, in late.
Had all kinds
but
of.
But overall, not a good candidate.
But overall, just he didn't resonate with people for whatever reason. Maybe given more time, he would have. Who knows? But you get this new crop, the Josh Steins who are running for lieutenant. You know, these attorney general.
Dan
you get
Lee
these
the new third people. For state treasurer.
Right. You get these. They don't have great recognition. It's sort of a new wave of Democrats. Can they break through in some of these races? Can you see Deborah Ross, who is not well, was not well known before she ran for Senate,
is still not isn't all
still
that well known.
Terribly well. But if you get this new crop and they can break through in a couple of races, and this would be a big one, then you can start to see some of that sort of shifting back to becoming more of a competitive all across the board Republican Democrat situation because of the way maps are drawn and who knows how that's all going to change. That can all be still remains to be seen, but this new crop of Democrats, there's a lot on them.
Right.
Because if they lose across the board, or if they lose a lot of these races, it's another, they have to regroup
again.
It's
another strike against them.
It's another regrouping effort.
It just solidifies GOP control, from my vantage point, through the end of the decade.
Yep.
But if they can crack through in a couple of these statewide races you mentioned, and then, you know, we look at, pardon me, some of the elections within the General Assembly, I think we've talked about this here before on the podcast. Can they take away the Republican supermajority in the House? Within the North Carolina Senate, that looks to be out of question. But if Republicans lose the supermajority in the North Carolina House, and if you couple that potentially with a Democrat in the governor's mansion and or an attorney general who is a Democrat, you suddenly have a landscape that is still controlled by Republicans, but a little more balanced in that Republicans can't get through everything they want. If you don't have a veto-proof majority, that means that the veto power, the veto pen of a Democratic governor looms a little more significantly in terms of what kind of policy you can push through. It's not a total shift in policy here in the state, but I think it's notable. I mean,
right.
I think it's.
And there will be some the Republicans would then have to reach out to some Democrats. Now, there's some Democrats who would be probably more than happy to, you know, work some of those negotiations who are more moderate. But certainly it would change things from that perspective. It would also just, I think, change things from a cult of personality. You know, you looked at the last couple of years at Democrats and you thought, well, who are the leaders of this party moving forward? And now, if this election goes in a couple of these places we're talking about for Democrats, you look at, okay, well, Roy Cooper is a leader. Josh Stein could be. Right. Deborah Ross. These could be people who then sort of set the table moving forward in this, you know, politics is a cult of personality on some level. When you've got Phil Berger on the other side and now Tom Tillis, and you've got these people who are sort of entrenched a little bit more, it's an interesting dynamic this year in that way, beyond just the individual races, I think. And finally, moving off a little bit of the Senate race, in our next podcast, maybe the next podcast, but very soon, we're going to look at a little bit of the sort of the history of the governor's office through the lens of some interesting stories and data that you've collected and compiled. Give us an idea of what you found in looking at some of this historical data about people who've served as this state's governor.
What hopefully we're going to do in a way that is digestible and interesting to some degree is look back at the governors of the last 100 years. That works out nicely, I guess, from fractions in that standpoint, as 20 governors. And what we're trying to do is look at, you know, where they were born, but I think a little bit more interestingly, more importantly, the education and the occupations of these governors, because they all had education and occupations. Not all of them were born in the state. They obviously were all born. Not all of them had military experience. Some of them did, as you would probably expect, 30s, 40s, you know, World War I into World War II or post-World War I into World War II. So looking at the education and occupations of the last 20 governors and also trying to get a sense of where they came from, what were they doing before they became governor? Many of them were in the state legislature. Not all of them, but many of those 20, as I've looked back on them, were members of the General Assembly. A few of them were lieutenant governors, a couple of attorney generals. So that there's the before, and then there's the after snapshot as well, which is interesting because as you look further back in time, anecdotally, I mean, I haven't crunched the numbers on this, but there were many more governors who then went on to become members of Congress in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s than there have been in recent time. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll get some analysis. We'll talk to some historians on this. I don't know if there's a reason for that, if it's just a changing landscape, that the money's better to go into the private sector,
right,
back to an attorney, work in education, so on and so forth. That is some of it. I mean, one interesting thing, as one nugget. So, of the 20 governors, I'll just throw you on the spot here. Do you care to guess as to how many have had a law degree?
Two thirds.
So it's 14 out of 20, which is 70%. So yeah, just about a little bit more than two thirds.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean,
on some level, that makes sense.
Sure.
Some of the more interesting things that I think, that we've talked about sort of, you know, through the hallways and other things is that, you know, North Carolina is, and I've heard this from other folks too, in North Carolina had one of the weakest governors as an office,
right,
of anybody in the country,
right,
mostly because North Carolina's governor was the last in the country to get veto power.
Right.
And the last, no, I don't know if the last in the country, but it wasn't until the early 1970s that you could even run for a second term.
So you
were in for 4 years and
right,
you were out before you could really establish different things. Now, of course, since then, we've had Governor Jim Hunt has had two consecutive, not, he's had 2 8-year terms,
right,
not consecutive.
Right.
The law is still you can run for a second term, then you can't run for a third consecutive, but then you can come back and run again,
right,
if you want to.
Right.
And given that interesting nugget,
yeah,
Governor McCrory, if he were to lose this election, he'd be the first incumbent ever to lose a bid for reelection,
mm-hmm,
in North Carolina. Now, well, it goes back to 70, whatever, too, I think, that you could do that.
I think the first time governors could run for re-election was actually 1980.
Right. Well, they passed it in 72, but Hunt,
right,
was the first one who ever tried,
right,
to run for re-election.
So Hunt, Martin, Easley, and am I forgetting one? I think Hunt, Martin, Easley, well, and Hunt again.
Right.
Right? So two Hunts, a Martin, and an Easley are the only four people in the history of the state, governors, to run for re-election. So governors running for re-election in the state are 4 for 4. Bev Perdue obviously did not 4
right,
years ago. She backed out pretty late in the game. So, you know, Governor McCrory is trying, it's a small sample size, but he is trying to avoid an ominous piece of history,
right,
which would be the first governor to run for re-election in this state and lose.
Right. And what would be interesting, I don't know the answer to this, and I don't know if you do, and I don't want to put you on the spot,
no,
but if anybody out there who does, who's listening to the podcast, wants to reach out, I'd love to know, you know, Governor McCrory lost his first bid for governor, but then he won the second time he
right,
ran. I wonder if there is anyone else in that category who ran once, didn't win, and came back and ran again and did.
And the short answer is yes. I swear I stumbled across that in my research, but I can't remember. It wasn't Holzhauser. I think there is one. I know you mentioned that the other day, and I don't have a good answer for you.
I'd be
you,
curious, and we'll do more research. And this, you know, we're talking about a podcast we're going to do in the future, and some work you're going to do both online and as
one
a
other point.
Story.
Sorry, I'm going to go one more quiz with you here. So
okay,
all the governors we've had in North Carolina history have been white. One has been a woman, Bev Perdue. There are 50 executives across the state. We're also going to try to loop in some contextual United States facts here. 31 Republicans, 18 Democrats, and
across
one,
the country.
Across right, the United States, yes.
Okay, yes.
31 Republicans, 18 Democrats, one independent. He is from Arkansas. Care to take a guess at how many women? That's part A of the question. And
uh-huh,
how many minorities there are in governorships presently?
Governorships presently.
Across the country. So what's the gender split and what is the white versus minority split?
That's a great question. I'm going to say...
You obviously did not know this question.
I have no idea this question was coming, and I don't, you know, I'm going to say three women, and I can't think of an African-American governor in this country right now.
There aren't any African-Americans, so I'll give you that clue as I tell you.
Right.
There are six women.
Okay.
South Carolina, Nikki Haley being the closest, but
right,
there are also women governors in Oregon, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Oklahoma for
those
savants at home.
Right.
If Ken Rudin's listening. And then in terms of, there are 46 whites and 4 minorities. And we're talking, I mean, Nikki Haley has
Indian American.
Indian American. And there are a couple of Hispanic Americans or Latinos in New Mexico and Nevada. And the governor of Hawaii, I believe, has ancestors from the Pacific Islands, from from Southeast Asia.
Interesting.
So not a representative snapshot, or not a snapshot that is in line with the demographics of our country or those states.
But not by a long shot.
Not surprising.
No, very interesting. Well,
anyway,
it'll be interesting to see what we come up with, or what you come up with, I should say, and how it comes about. But it is, we're going to spend a lot of time on the governor's race here in North Carolina. And it is an important, it's a vital position in this state. It's really interesting that, to look at the history and see how it's evolved.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeff Tiberi is WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief. That's it for the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play and follow all the WUNC Politics stories on air and online. See you next week.